Hello everyone, today I'm thrilled to welcome Candice Elsmore to the show. Candice has built an incredible career at the intersection of technology, operations, finance, and people. Originally from South Africa, she has lived, worked, and studied across three continents, including earning her degree from London Business School. Candice has started as an investment banker at Goldman Sachs before transitioning into chief staff of role, where she led a team of 100 employees and helped shape hiring and strategy. Beyond that, Candice has scaled and sold an advisory business as a COO and now brings her expertise to the UAE as a strategic advisor, helping startups and scale-ups grow in the dynamic market of the GCC. In today's episode, Candice will reveal key lessons on scaling startups and taking scale-ups to the next level. Candice, welcome to the IJK podcast.
Great to be here, and really thank you for having me on the show, Imad. I really appreciate it.
You're most welcome. Candice, you've had a fascinating career spanning investment banking, a chief of staff role, and working with scale-ups. Can you share a little bit about your journey and what drew you to the startup world?
Yes, absolutely. So I think it's always interesting to see where things began. So as you mentioned, I'm from South Africa. I grew up in a home where my dad was an entrepreneur. And, you know, I think that was kind of seeing how businesses are built and what goes into successfully launching and scaling a business, albeit it's a different industry, was something that was always kind of in my DNA. And I remember being very curious about how you scale businesses, what makes a business successful and what doesn't make a business successful. I studied finance at university. I thought it was an interesting way to kind of build expertise, because I do believe everything ultimately boils down to the numbers once you have the business model sorted. So it was a natural point for me. Once I'd finished undergrad and worked in finance, I really wanted to see the rest of the world. So I moved to London and did my MBA at LBS and spent some time at Wharton in the University of Pennsylvania. And post that, started working in investment banking. And there I was advising companies, buying and selling. I was fortunate enough to advise Aston Martin on its IPO in 2018, and really got a sort of bitten by the entrepreneurship bug, but from the perspective of advising companies. And then when I moved into the chief of staff role and ultimately the COO role, I got another piece, which was working with people. How do you grow and put the best people into a team so you can execute that strategic vision? And as you mentioned, working at a business where I was the COO, it was a sale to a global investment bank. That was kind of a natural inflection point for me to think about what's next and how do I get into the real economy, and had a fortuitous move to Dubai, and I've been working with businesses in technology, really focused on this intersection between finance, people, operations, and technology, working with founders. And I have to say, it's something I absolutely love. I'm very always drawn to the Steve Jobs quote that you need to look at things from the perspective of how they look looking back versus looking forward, connecting the dots backwards. And I can say that a lot of the experience that I've had has really brought me to this place where I'm in a, you know, great position now to be working with so many fantastic startups.
Great. Very exciting. Candice, what are key lessons that you've learned from your time at Goldman Sachs, and which ones have been really most valuable to you as a businesswoman?
I think it's really been the focus on team. Goldman is a fantastic organization from the perspective of it's really driven by this team first culture. You know, we win as a team, we lose as a team. And you start to think about how your behavior matters in the context of a team. And I think they have a fantastic way of thinking about always putting the client first and really focusing on what the end outcome that you're trying to drive to. And I think when you focus on the why of what you're doing, trying to deliver the most value for your client, it has an amazing way to focus the mind. And I think that piece around inclusivity of how you build a team as well as always trying to do the best job possible, whether you're doing it for your client or internally, thinking about your actions in the context of the broader why has definitely been lessons that I've been fortunate enough to apply into in the startups that I work with today. And I think that's been really helpful for me and hugely kind of fond memories for me of my time.
Okay. Did you used to work long hours and, on weekends as well?
Yes. Yes. I think that's the name of the game in advisory.
Yes, absolutely. I've actually worked myself in investment banking in London for a few years before I shifted to another industry. But I worked for Merrill Lynch. Back then, I was in their M&A team. I was covering the healthcare sector at that time. And I remember.
Okay, so you know all about it.
I do.
You're an expert on this.
I do. Okay, so let's talk a little bit about the process of moving a startup to a scale-up, which is our main topic for today. So many startups struggle with this transition, right? In your experience, what are the key indicators that a company is ready to scale?
I think you've got to, this magical term of product market fit. You breaking that down, you've achieved product market fit. So you have repeatable business, you have a proven revenue model, and you have some initial customers. If we think about things in the B2C or the B2B case, you have some initial customers and they've shown retention. So you kind of know what your product is, and it's a case of, we can see this huge opportunity in front of us, but now we need to put in place the people, the processes, the systems, and in most cases, the funding, so we can actually go after this market opportunity. So I really think you've tested where the business, there's a fit for that particular business and there's a market for that business. And you're now just at a point where in order to go after this huge opportunity, you need to actually put all of the factors which I've mentioned behind you, so you can go and do that.
Mm-hmm. I see. What are some common or big mistakes founders usually make when trying to do that, to do the scale up, or to scale up too early, or let's say too aggressively sometimes?
I think the product market fit, and again, it's understanding whether there's a market for you, the product that you're offering, and you're clear on what the value that you deliver to whoever your specific customer is. So assuming that piece is done, because obviously you can pivot, but pivoting when you've hired people in seats to do a particular role and then you need to change the strategy is tricky. I would say the typical mistakes I see or have seen founders make is not spending enough time focused on hiring and making sure that you're hiring for obviously competence and culture. Because you really are going to need to make sure you have people who are very much focused on the vision and are culturally aligned in terms of what you're trying to execute, versus just getting, the people on in seats. You may not be able to pay them the same as everybody else. Everybody's aware. We spoke briefly about the banking and the hours. The hours are going to be challenging in a different way, but it's going to be quite demanding. And maybe the upside is a bit more risky, because most startups are not becoming unicorns. So how do you put everybody behind the team? But I think it's really not spending enough time on hiring. Once you put the people in the place, not thinking about the process and the procedures, things need to be scalable. And sometimes failing to delegate and failing to put into those processes, because it's easier for the founder to do it, they can be it more efficient, but then the kind of business never grows beyond them. And I think that's a hard sort of psychological change for most founders to make.
Absolutely. When you talk about hiring before scaling, do you mean hiring like the right leadership team, or do you mean like hiring in general, like employee, like in having enough employees to serve the incoming business?
Yes, I think both. I think obviously both. It's important to get, no one leader is great at everything and no one person is great at everything. And when you're doing things in the startup phase, it's understandable. You're going to be very scrappy. You're going to be doing very lean, but once you've taken the business to the point where you are now at a position to scale, you need to kind of look at your collective deficiencies or mm-hmm. areas where you could use some bolstering and you need to hire into those seats. So it's important that you kind of really have a firm view on what those things are and where do you need to strategically augment within the business and how do you need to train people, because they'll be increasingly moving into specialization roles. So I think it's kind of, you know, this constant, you know, great talent, in my view, is a huge enabler of any business. And it's sometimes undervalued a lot by business leaders because, you know, I think it's just, it's such an easy one to overlook.
Absolutely, absolutely. And when those startups are on their way to scaling up, how can they maintain a strong company culture? Because, you know, the growth will be rapid, the hiring will be also intense. How can they make sure that they maintain a strong company culture? I think this also has to play some role as well, right?
Exactly. So I think being clear on what the why is, why are you doing this business, and making sure that, I've heard of some founders that they have a company mission statement or they have the key, you know, USP of a particular company. And the reason they're doing that is because they want every single person, whether it's the person who is answering the phone to customers all the way to the salesperson to the CFO, to be clearly able to articulate the value that that company brings. So you need to find systems and channels, whether that be an all hands, whether that be, you know, a management structure, where you're going to be able to communicate that vision and have a systematic way to do it and make sure that everybody's on the same page. Because when you go from, you know, 0 to 25, 25 to 100, you're not going to be able to, you know, distribute that messaging in the same way that you did when the company was 0 to 25. And that can be a challenge because it kind of, you know, you have to be changing your spots, as it were.
I see, I see. I'd like to talk a little bit now about funding versus profitability. So There's often a tension between those two worlds, right? Like raising money to sustain the growth, but at the same time reaching profitability. What advice can you give founders to balance those two different criteria?
Look, and I think you've hit the nail on the head. It is an extremely difficult decision. Because, you know, funding, I'm working with a company now who's just raised their first seed fund. And I was speaking to the founder this morning, and he said to me, I said, well, at least you finished your funding round. And he goes, he's like, yeah, Candice, we're never finished funding. So that is the challenge. You know, when you do start initially funding, you are never kind of fully finished. So I think people need to understand that there's a whole set of responsibilities and requirement, including dilution, but also just the kind of reporting piece that goes with it that you need to consider. And then also what kinds of capital that you're looking for. I mean, I don't think all capital is created equal, and you should be thinking about potential capital providers, not just from the kind of quantum of the check that they can provide, but also the network, the strategic augmentation of skills. So that's kind of a separate point. But I do think it's something that people shouldn't think lightly, because it does create a set of expectations and a certain requirements that become on the business. But I think when you, I guess the kind of bootstrapped versus sourcing external capital, I think when you have, you know, stable revenue streams, when it's clear that you can probably grow a lot of the business without having to take that dilution, and it's not kind of a winner takes all meant market, so i.e. the market will still be there and your ability to enter that market will still be the same regardless of what happens, then I would say, you know, probably I would advise, you know, focus on the business, customer funded sort of growth. And then if you need to get raise money, you'll be able to do it at different terms. And you'll probably also have a better sense of what you need to bring into the business. I think the case for getting capital is when there's a huge revenue opportunity, there's a huge market, and there's no way that you could build what you needed to build in terms of even a minimal viable product without huge injections to capital. But then obviously, as I mentioned, you do need to have this consideration of, you know, the terms that you're going to be raising at, the kind of requirements that this is going to put on the business, and the potential that you may lose your business if the VCs move you on because they feel that you're no longer sort of fit for the task. So again, I think we shouldn't necessarily see raising funding as a mark of success. It absolutely is. Somebody is sort of giving that stamp of approval to your business, but it comes with other kind of considerations, which I would encourage all founders to think about as well.
Okay, let's talk a bit about the amounts involved. So when someone is starting a company, so they are at the startup phase, they typically raise either angel investment or they bootstrap, right? Or maybe some seed funding. And the tickets are usually small. When we talk about scaling up, what is the typical ticket amount? How much, or maybe if you can give us a range to understand a little bit, what amounts are we talking about when we talk about scaling up?
I think it can go anywhere between sort of 10 to 100 million. But I think even saying that, I'm a bit hesitant because it really depends on the kind of
U.S.
business.
Dollars? You're talking about in terms of dollars?
Yes, U.S. dollars,
right?
Okay. Yeah.
Okay.
So I think it's really about what is your valuation? And then also, what do you need the funds for? I mean, people are looking to have some, because assuming at the scaling up phase, you're probably a Series B raise. People are going to want to understand where that money's going. And, you know, typically it's because you need to invest in the sales force. Maybe if you're an AI business, it's because you need to do a huge amount of R&D and eventually CapEx investment in terms of being able to build your product. So I think the range is pretty huge, because even the kind of venture or growth community, because when you move into scale up, I would say that's the kind of ballpark that you're in, are not entirely uniform in their idea of what the scale up number is. But I would say it's probably north of the 10 million number is what I've seen.
Okay.
But again, I think it depends on market to market.
For sure, for sure. I'd like to shift gears a little bit and talk about operations, because operations are, you know, very important in the topic we're talking about. So what operational inefficiencies you commonly see in startups, and how can they be fixed before actually the founders go and seek the scale-up money that you just mentioned?
I think it's really kind of looking at everything so the life cycle of your business, you know, depending on what you are, how, you know, let's just take something as basic as kind of your human capital part of a business. So how are you hiring? Do you have a somewhat structured hiring process? Do you keep a record of the candidates that you've tracked, the feedback? Do you have a organized folder with everybody's contracts? Do you know, that's not really the operational piece of the business in terms of the driving the engine of the business, but it's definitely something that, you know, you want to have structures, processes in terms of how you hire people, how you onboard them, and then there's some level of consistency in that approach, because quickly that the sort of hiring piece becomes very, very important very quickly. And when that is not organized, it can all of a sudden you're scrambling. What did we pay this one? Why is this one's contract different to that one? You potentially have a lot of headaches on your hands. So I would say looking at your processes. In another company I've been working with, they had a small development team building an app, and then also having some development work for select clients. It was a globally distributed, i.e. remote first team, and they didn't really have any structured ways of working, which was totally fine when it was a small company. But as the operations grew, it meant that, you know, client requests kind of just got lost. Things didn't get happened, and ultimately that impacts your retention. So systematizing, whether it's a productivity tool like a Jira or an Asana, can be really helpful. You can start to think of what technology solutions exist to take away the human intervention and sort of touch points and ultimately opportunities for things to go wrong in all aspects of your business. And very often now, I believe there's a lot of kind of technology solutions, which are not hugely expensive, but can be a huge enabler for your business.
I see. Now, if we talk as well about growth, you know, some startups have been able to achieve rather rapid growth, but then it was short-lived, versus others who have been able to show like progressive growth, but that was more sustainable. Do you see these scenarios play out often in your day-to-day work? And what advice can you give to startups to basically, rather than chasing like short-lived but explosive growth, focus on sustainable growth and then maybe building one block at a time?
So I think, I mean, it's a great question. I would say for me, what I've seen, and again, in not a sample size, which is anywhere near representative of all startups, but I would say, you know, looking at the kind of customers, particularly in the B2B SaaS or B2B enterprise space, you know, there's a tendency to think of all customers as being equal. And, you know, sales are sales. But, you know, thinking about things about, you know, not all customers are going to be equally profitable. And, you know, looking at kind of sustainable revenue. And I think this is something that's not even a startup question. It's a question that I saw in my banking days as well, is what kind of business is business, which is the kind of business that you should be doing, versus the kind of business which is marginal and looks like you'll have some impact to revenue today, but in the future is probably going to be pretty difficult, not part of your kind of, you know, building into your why of repeatable long-term customer relationships. This is something that is probably going to churn very quickly and not really within your strategic wheelhouse. So it's going to probably be a pretty painful client to service. So I think that's a long way of saying, thinking about who is your customer, what is your customer that you're trying to solve for and going after that, versus chasing revenue at all costs, which is totally normal and understandable. But when you kind of have a business that you're trying to run and you do need to kind of have pivots, I'm not suggesting to not go for clients, but I think it's really about thinking about your ideal customer and trying to pursue those ones and focusing when to close doors that need to be closed versus trying to keep everything open for optionality.
Okay. I see. I get that you are currently based in the UAE, correct? So in the United Arab Emirates. And the UAE is emerging as a global startup hub. So what advantages does it offer for scale-ups compared to other regions?
I think there are a couple. It's very new. So I would still say that the transition from a startup to scale-up seems to be easier to do in more developed markets where there is a larger pool of capital and incentive schemes to fund money into startups and ultimately scale ups. I think the piece that people is really attractive is probably it has its geographic positioning is important. It is serving as an interesting corridor between East and West. India is a 3-hour flight away. You have Pakistan, so this whole sort of positioning itself as a corridor into places like the global South. Africa is very close. As I mentioned, the subcontinent, its proximity to Europe, and in a little bit further the US. So I think the geographic positioning is incredibly important. I think there are huge capital providers, particularly in the case of the sovereign wealth funds. The UAE and Saudi and Qatar, all of the regions have their own equivalent of a sovereign wealth fund. And these are putting huge amounts of capital behind more large established Western businesses. When I say Western, I'm thinking of OpenAI or SpaceX, which have raised in the past, but they are increasingly putting money aside for accelerator businesses. I think their focus on trying to build global dominance, particularly in fields like technology and artificial intelligence, the safety aspect is one that is very important. And then I think the ease of doing business. They've really tried to remove as many barriers as possible to set up business here, and they're trying to attract the very best talent that they can, albeit from a lower base than other developed markets. So I think that it's, and we're seeing that particularly from places like the UK, the number of entrepreneurs who are moving into the region, as a recognition of the fact that it's, it is already a very attractive place to do business, but it's becoming more and more attractive place for business.
I see. And I guess as well, taxes and the tax regime is favorable there as well.
Exactly. Particularly for founders, as they think about an exit, and potentially growing the business, just to be able to do so under a zero income tax regime and also a lot of favorable tax arrangement, depending on which free zone, assuming you're in the UAE, you go into, you can have 0% income tax under certain situations. It's extremely, appealing for entrepreneurs.
Mm-hmm, I see. But I did hear somewhere that taxes are being introduced, but at a much slower pace than elsewhere in the world, correct?
I think where I've seen it is Oman. And I think it's a high single-digit number for taxes. And what I heard for the UAE is that it's not, they were recently, I think they said at Davos, it was not on the cards at this point. So maybe at some point, the only change is constant. So maybe at some point they will be introduced. But
yes,
I think probably even at a very, very low competitive rate compared to the rest of the world. Singapore, from what I understand, is sort of low teens and is still a hub for capital and talent. So, yeah.
I see. Okay. Are there specific industries in the region that you see as particularly primed for scaling? So what are some sectors in the GCC that you see that maybe have more success or may potentially have more success than others?
So I think the traditional industry that I've seen, and this I wouldn't say is a scaling, but I think if you can be in and around the ecosystem, is real estate. It's very much a real estate market. As I mentioned, the technology focus is absolutely something that governments are trying to position themselves and are succeeding in terms of creating technological sort of powerhouse and home of innovation. So transitioning the economies away from traditional petrochemicals to more knowledge-based industries. Then there's a piece around food security and also just agriculture in general. So I've seen some interesting startups. The name is evading me now, but where it's all aquaculture driven and not having and being done in a very sustainable way. So I think that is a piece. There's also a big focus on sustainability, which I know is moving out of favor in a number of markets if we think about the US, but they are still very much focused on climate change. So I think, I think technology, I think a lot of consumer businesses also do very well. The GCC is looking I think Dubai is wanting to double the size of its population. And that would be sort of expat driven. So I think, you're going to have so many sort of services related to just to service this huge population growth that they're looking to have. So I think a lot of consumer businesses could do very well as well, fintech. But I guess my my wheelhouse would be more in the tech space, where I think there could be the most positive impact.
Absolutely. I mean, now that you mentioned tech, I'd like to talk a bit about the role of AI in this sector. So AI is, as you know, transforming business operations and, you know, businesses in general. How do you see AI impacting startups and scale-ups in the next, say, 5 to 10 years?
I think the impact will be huge. I've heard a number of people talk about the ability to have a startup with, you know, in the future, will we be having, you know, startups with a $1 billion valuation who have, you know, 10 to 15 people as employees, not out of the realm of sort of conception. I think it allows people to probably wait slightly longer before they make some of those key strategic hires, because you're able to embed AI in a lot of your processes and also kind of strategic thinking, that it can be a huge enabler. So in one of my most recent roles, where I was COO of a startup, we didn't really have an HR team. We didn't have a dedicated finance function. And in order to do things in a pretty effective way, we would use AI in the form of LLMs. And when I'm talking, you know, Perplexity, ChatGPT, and Claude from Anthropic. And this was just what could take days in terms of data analysis, in terms of thinking through contracts, in terms of hiring, in terms of scheduling, in terms of automating processes, which maybe were not very high value add, but took an incredibly long amount of time, is just huge. And then you start to say, well, maybe do we need an extra pair of hands? Maybe we can sort of get by without it. So I think it's a huge enabler. And I think you can just do so much now, so much more cost effectively using AI than was possible maybe 5 years ago.
I see. Absolutely. I mean, AI has definitely transformed multiple departments and job roles, I guess, and more is to come, of course. Is AI as an industry, you mentioned that the UAE is a technology hub as well, so a lot of startups are within that space. Do you see, maybe from first-hand experience, some startups that are in AI specifically that have a potential to succeed on a global level from the region, let's say not only UAE, but UAE or GCC in general?
Yes, I'm trying to think off the top of my head names. And it will come to me, but I don't have them off the top of my head. But I think that's the one of the great things about the new sort of technological wave. I do think that it's increasingly democratizing the opportunities for people to be competitive on a global stage. I think there are certain figures, sort of questions around, you know, we see it particularly in the LLM space. There's very few companies of scale who are able to do it, because it's just really, really expensive. So, you know, I'm thinking about the LLMs. There's probably not going to be too many of those popping up. I mean, DeepSeek was quite a surprise for many people in terms of the sort of relative pricing sort of advantageous they had, so from a compute perspective. But what I see more is the LLM wrappers. So it's people building on the application layer using LLMs, which whatever side of the fence you sit, most people are, there's a school of thought now which potentially they may become more of a commodity, and it's the kind of application layer which will be more of the enabler in the business. So I think it's increasingly becoming sort of reduced barriers to entry for a number of businesses, but I think it will be still dependent on what kind of a problem you're solving and the capital that you can need to do it. Because I do think training models is very expensive, and then you need to be in a place where the compute is affordable enough. And if we think of places like Europe, which I've hearing some feedback on the UK, it's going to be hard to do that given how expensive the electricity is. But I guess in the UAE, that's something they do benefit from.
I see. You mentioned previously that in your previous startup, you utilized AI to do many tasks. So how can founders basically think as well about integrating AI technologies into their businesses without, overcomplicating too much the matter? Do you have some advices based on what you've lived?
I would use it as a co-pilot or a friend, a very smart friend. Asking it questions, I can give you a range of topics. I would, I have this particular problem. Help me think through some potential solutions. I need to reach out to X customers today, and my goal of this conversation is to achieve Y. Write the email for me. Help me. My model's not working. I'm working in Excel. Help me figure out the code. There's so much that you can use it for, and I think the easiest is just to start working with it by asking it questions, because questions on things which actually matter to you. Obviously, it's great to ask it, help me think of a birthday idea for my kid. But I think that, when you start to see how powerful it can be in terms of helping you think through business problems, I think that's when you see this real enablement. So I use it. I probably spend 2 to 3 hours on it per day. And I'm sure that's saved me 10 to 15x in terms of time I would have lost if I weren't using it. So I think it can really be, from everything from pitch decks to sort of dialogues to, the setting up processes and the procedures. It's just huge.
Yes, absolutely. So you advise founders and startup executives to use it as an advisor, as a co-pilot, someone they can kind of ask questions at any point, anytime, regarding any topics. So,
exactly.
They can support them.
Yes. I was just going to say, obviously you need to be mindful about the kind of data that you're putting in there, even if it's on a temporary chat. There are regulations, particularly in Europe and the UK with regards to data protection, where you have to be mindful, don't stick in customer contracts in there. But I do think because it's going to, potentially will be, the way it's stored, it's important. But I think you can ask a lot of questions and help get a steer. I find for when you become more senior, it becomes increasingly a bit lonely, because you don't necessarily have the group of people that you can ask questions to in a kind of confidential way. And know that you're going to get a somewhat transparent answer. But I think in terms of prompting dialogue, using AI can be incredibly helpful.
All right. I'd like to talk a bit about exit strategies now and long-term visions. So what should founders think about early on when planning for an eventual exit? So what are some strategies or tips that you can provide them?
I think it's really... I think the two key exits are looking at potentially, there's obviously the IPO, there is being sold to someone and potentially merging the business. Great businesses, probably there's a lot of businesses which can be, they may make a lot of strategic sense to another large acquirer. I'm thinking Microsoft bought LinkedIn. There could have been another scenario where they IPO'd. But there's always looking at those two scenarios, particularly when companies reach a certain size. I would say that when you're at the startup phase or even the scale-up phase, most of the time when investors are putting money in your business, they're doing it on the basis that they expect a given level of return. And on that assumption, they are thinking, what is the potential exit strategy of this business? I think it's something to kind of have as a North Star, because a number of the attributes of a publicly listed company and a business which makes an attractive merger target or a merger target to potentially a strategic or a private equity, you know, fundamentally they want a sound business model. I think there are obviously pros and cons to both. IPO markets, it's quite cyclical. Both are cyclical. But, you know, it's going to be dependent on, you know, where are you based? Most European founders, for example, know that the place to exit, if they can, is the US, because the multiples are just so much better than they are in Europe. So that's a strategic consideration that you need to think of. You know, is there enough liquidity? Is there going to be a pool of investors who understand the business? Is there a concentration of that capital? I would say that is something where the UAE, they recently had the IPO of Talabat, but it's, you know, in the GCC, capital markets aren't as deep as they are in other big markets. So that is something absolutely to think of. I would not say that I would be thinking to IPO a business, one of the startups that I was working with here, because probably you really need to be a certain size and scale for that to happen. I also think the considerations of a public company are quite different. You know, there's the complexity that comes with dealing with public shareholders. There's a level of scrutiny. You're working towards sort of quarterly targets, which is a different level of stress. And I think that's why you've seen a lot of listed company CEOs moving to private equity back businesses, because they just don't want to deal with the headache of having to deal with public shareholders. So I do think from the get-go, you should think about what an exit could be. And absolutely any investor at any point in the journey is going to want to know what could be my potential exit. But I think the focus should be on trying to grow a sustainable business versus something that is probably takes a lot longer than what you think, maybe 10 to 15 years, and is going to be quite a challenging journey. But I think if you can think of having a sound business, long-term customer contracts, repeatable revenue, sort of increasing LTVs, positive renewal rates, I think that is kind of be the kind of key driver of the business, which is something I would think of before I thought of exit.
I see. I understand. And Candice, if you could give one piece of advice to founders currently preparing to scale, what would that be?
I think I've heard an expression, entrepreneurship is a team sport. So I think having those network of individuals that can be, you know, your trusted board of advisors and people that you can speak to and get advice from very early on. I think as human beings, we love having a degree of certainty. And I think entrepreneurship is one of those journeys where the path is not certain. So I would say building that sense of community, and that probably happens over time as you get investors, hopefully, if you choose ones which are additive in that sense, where you can get advice. But I would say my piece is really around building, you know, that sense of community to help you in your journey, and then trying to validate the business as often as possible. You know, I think we often have a tendency, not entrepreneurs as but people in general, kind of live in their own echo chambers. And I think you want to get as early as possible with minimum viable products to be testing that and be getting feedback so you can iterate.
Okay. Do you have a favorite like an entrepreneur or successful startup founder that you consider as a role model on a personal level?
On a personal level, it's a very good question. And I hadn't thought about it. I would
like
say...
Like Elon Musk, maybe, because he's from the same country as originally.
Yes. He's definitely a genius. And I think he thinks about the world in a very creative way. And I admire his sort of commitment to doing things which are really life-changing. I think for me, probably would be Reid Hoffman, the founder of LinkedIn. You know, he's been involved in so many different businesses. And I think the way that he approaches challenges, he's a very much a human sort of compassionate driven leader. And I think there's a value piece for me, which I really align with him on that. And so I would have to say it would probably be Reid Hoffman, although Elon Musk is a force of nature. And the other person who I was initially thinking of was Steve Jobs. I think there's something that's quite amazing about how you can be so committed and driven to a concept or an idea, even in the face of setbacks. So, I think those two.
Absolutely. Steve Jobs has changed everything in the past 10 to probably 20 years since the iPod and the advent of iPhones. So he reshaped the way we live our lives to a certain extent and how we communicate with with technology, basically. Yeah, absolutely.
One thing I would say is also this kind of, I think I really resonate with the idea of being driven by a broader vision, like what are you trying to do? And I think Apple's Think Different is really this kind of idea of, you know, what is your why? You know, the importance of understanding your why. I think I definitely feel an affinity for leaders who are able to do that.
Absolutely. Candice, where can listeners connect with you or learn more about your work and your services?
LinkedIn. I'm pretty active on LinkedIn, and I'd love to connect with anyone who, kind of has a question or just wants to learn more. LinkedIn is the best place to go, and it's Candice Elsmore.
Perfect. Candice, it's been a very exciting episode. We talked about startups, scale-ups. You've shared many useful tips that I think our listeners are going to for sure find big value in. Would you like to conclude by saying any final words?
Well, just thank you for giving me the opportunity, Ahmad, to come and speak today. I'd love those really interesting questions. And I always like to share ideas and exchange thoughts with other sort of business individuals such as yourself. So thank you so much for inviting me and giving me the opportunity.
You're most welcome. It was a very fascinating discussion. Thank you very much again.
Thank you so much.
All right. Take care.
Bye.
Bye now. Bye.